G'day everyone, you're listening to Cameron Riley on the Podcast Network, episode 391. My guest today is the founder of Planet Ark and the founder of a new social activism enterprise called Do Something. His name is John Dee. Now, if you're like me and you live in Australia, you've obviously heard of Planet Ark over nearly 20 years of work that they've been doing to build environmental awareness and also to engage businesses and governments with changing their practices, changing legislation to make us more of an environmentally friendly and sustainable country. But I didn't know a lot about John Dee before I had the chance to chat to him a few days ago. Found out that he has a very interesting story. Comes from a background in rock music, mixing with some of the big British rock bands, and then through that ended up meeting Australian tennis pro Pat Cash, and then they decided to go and do something to make the world a better place, and that was Planet Ark. So it's a tremendous story. I had a chat to John a few days ago. As I said, we capture all of this background, where he came from, why they started Planet Ark, and what they're doing now with Do Something, including trying to get rid of bottled water, trying to get rid of plastic bags, and trying to get rid of paper with the Paperless Alliance. Now, he's one of the people who I really admire, because it's not just talk for John. It's been 20 years of getting out there, making things happen, working with corporations and government to make it happen. I think there's a lot that I can learn from John's example, and I hope you find this an interesting show. Here he is, John Dee.
The Podcast Network is supported by Neo.org, a social network with a purpose, to transform the world by enabling people to transform themselves, and Tony Kynaston, our first TPN patron. Become a TPN patron or a member of the TPN 500 by visiting tpn.thepodcastnetwork.com.
Let's go right back to the beginning. Before we start talking about Do Something, I'd like to go back, because I got to admit, I don't know a lot about you. Well, I didn't until I did my research. But, you know, obviously we've all heard of Planet Ark, but I don't know much about the John Dee story. You were born in the UK?
Yes, indeed. I was born in the UK back in 1964. And since I was, when I was 17, I got working for the rock band Yes, and running their fan club, and through that got to meet Pink Floyd, Led Zeppelin, Queen, and everyone else. And that's why my career started doing charity events with lots of these major rock bands, and through that ended up getting into charity work full-time, organizing events, organizing campaigns that were very much high-profile based, very populist in their approach, trying to get as many people involved as possible. And that's how my career started.
You will say that again. You were running the fan club.
That's right. I was 17, and I was really into Yes. It was one of those 1970s rock bands, 20, 30 minute songs, and I loved
John Anderson, right?
John Anderson.
I see all good people.
you know your music.
I know. Yes, man. Yeah, they were huge. So you went from running the fan, or like the official fan club, or an unofficial fan club?
Yeah, no, I worked very closely with the band, so they used to give me access to doing interviews and photos, going to rehearsals. So I sat in on the recording for the owner of A Lonely Heart Sessions, which, as you know, were massive. You know, they had the number one hit single in America and the UK with that. And so I sat in on that, and I got to sit in with a lot of really top people who were associated with Yes. So Vangelis, I used to know quite well when I was young, and so I sat in when he was recording Blade Runner, the soundtrack, which was that was an amazing experience, and got to sit in with Trevor Horn producing a number of records. So it was a fun time as a kid. I got to hang out with some really talented musicians, and I learnt a lot. And one of the exciting things that happened 20 years ago, I ended up getting all the guys together from Queen, Pink Floyd, Black Sabbath, Deep Purple, and everyone else, and got them to do a new version of Smoke on the Water for me, and I had a top 40 hit with that in the UK, and that was very exciting. And so coming out next month, I'll be in Armenia with the president of Armenia, launching the 20th anniversary remix of that myself and Do Something have just organized, and that's going to go worldwide through iTunes. And the aim of that is to raise more money for people who are still affected in the Armenian earthquake zone 20 years later. And they were the people we organized that whole fundraiser for. And it's still shockingly bad over there in some parts of Armenia. So we're getting the guys together. So Ian Gillan from Deep Purple, Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath, Jeff Downs from Yes, and myself, and my co-founder of Do Something Pat Cash, where we'll be in Armenia next month launching it globally.
When you say that they did it for you and you had a hit, what did you do? Did you just produce it, or did you do vocals, or what did you do on
it? I produced it, and I played some keyboards on it too. So it was there was a lot of fun pulling them together, because on guitar I managed to get in David Gilmour from Pink Floyd, Brian May from Queen, Tony Iommi from Black Sabbath, Richard Blackmore from Deep Purple, and Alex Lifeson from Rush. And we had Ian Gillan from Purple on vocals. We had Bruce Dickinson from Iron Maiden. We had Paul Rogers from Free. And we were so full that Brian Adams could only be squeezed in on backing vocals. And then we had Roger Taylor from Queen on drums. And I got Chris Squire from Yes on bass. And Jeff Downs from Yes on keyboards as well. So it was a fantastic record. And it was a lot of fun going back in and remixing it this time around. So I've done that with a guy called Josh Vermitt here in Australia. And it was really interesting. 20 years ago, we recorded this record at Metropolis Studios, which was is state of the art, and then it was a million pound studio. And what's interesting is in this studio we used, which was totally computer based here in Australia, where we did the remix, we could do more with the audio using an Apple Macintosh now than we could the years ago using this, all these big, mixing desks and state-of-the-art stuff that just cost a fortune. And these days you can do a lot more, a lot easier. So it's been a really interesting experience going back and remixing it and finding just how much easier it is to do.
And that's coming out on iTunes, you said.
That'll be coming out on iTunes next month. So we're literally, we've got George Marino, who mastered the last AC/DC album. He's mastering the track next week in New York. So the record will be finished, and then we move on to editing the whole promotional video for that, because we actually did a documentary about the whole making of Smoke on the Water that we released in Japan. And so we're going to be releasing the documentary through iTunes, and we'll be editing the new promo video as well. So it's been a lot of fun. It's been a lot of work for that project, but 100% of the money that we get in from iTunes is going to go straight to the earthquake zone. So we're not taking any money out for administration. All that money will be going in. And that's one of the reasons Pat Cash and I left Planet Ark after 16 years. We wanted to get back into doing some of our social campaigns. So we'll still do environmental campaigns, but we wanted to carry on again doing some of our social campaigns that we did before we started Planet Ark back in 1991. So Pat and I first worked together on Rock Aid Armenia back in 1990. And so it's nice for Pat getting back to our roots and doing fundraising and trying to help people who aren't, those people like you and I.
How did the two of you meet?
Well, we were introduced by Ian Gillan from Deep Purple because after I did Smoke on the Water, I thought, how am I going to follow that up? And I knew that Pat Cash played guitar. I knew John McEnroe played guitar. So I ended up speaking to Gillan and said, why don't we do a record with these guys? And Gillan thought it was a good idea, and he introduced me to Pat. I then got Iron Maiden to do the backing track for me for the bass and drums and the rhythm guitar. And then I called up Roger Daltrey from The Who and got him to agree to do the vocals. I just didn't tell him who the guitarists were going to be until it was too late for him to say no. But I did give him a promise that if John and Pat didn't nail the guitars, then, we'd bring in session guitarists. And fortunately, we didn't need to do that. That John and Pat really nailed the guitar parts. And so we're re-releasing Rock and Roll. It was the Rock and Roll, the Led Zeppelin track that we did. So I thought that was a good one to choose because John Paul Jones from Zeppelin had helped with some of the initial advice on pulling together Smoke on the Water, and we thought, well, we should do a Zep track too. So so we did that, and it's actually a fantastic version, and it was interesting hearing it again for getting it together for the remasters that we're releasing, and it sounds so much heavier and more rock and roll than Led Zeppelin's version of rock and roll. So that was it's going to be exciting releasing that again. Daltrey's vocals on it are absolutely fantastic, and McEnroe and Cash play guitar incredibly well on it. So it'll surprise a lot of people who haven't heard it before.
I'm actually surprised to hear that they can play guitar that well.
Oh, they really do. It was interesting with Pat. Pat really rehearsed. I mean, Pat's done, you know, at least 100 gigs, I would think, over time. And, you know, he's a really, really good guitarist. And what was interesting is with Pat, he really rehearsed it because we did the backing tracks already, so Pat rehearsed it. And when he went in, he literally did everything in 3 takes. He just nailed it. It was absolutely fantastic.
Wow. So how did Planet Ark come about?
Well, again, it was Pat Cash and I. We finished doing the rock and roll track, and then basically Pat was playing in Wimbledon, and he got knocked out, and he gave me a call and said, "Oh, I'm going overseas. Do you want to catch up tonight and have something to eat? And I've got a case full of Stella Artois from Queens. We've got to drink them, you know." And I thought, well, I'll do the right thing. I'll help him with that. And so I went over to his place, and it's safe to say we had way too much to drink. And as we got drunker, we thought, okay, well, how are we going to follow up rock and roll? And I really, you know, Pat's now one of my very closest friends and has been for 20 years. And so we basically decided to do another charity project. But I suggested, why don't we actually do a charity project that we commit to for a long-term basis, not just a one-off event like the version of rock and roll that we did, but do something ongoing and set up an organization. And we both agreed there needed to be an environmental group that could work with business and that could give business good quality advice, that would do so in a way that was positive and constructive, not in a way of trying to just beat up on business, because we felt that, you know, if businesses could be recruited to help the environment, then you're always going to, you know, achieve a great result, because businesses, when they really apply themselves to things, can get fantastic results. And so we decided to set up Planet Ark, and we thought, well, the best place to set it up would be Australia, you know, and all my friends are Australian. You know, Pat's obviously Australian, my wife is Australian, and so it just seemed logical that I would up sticks from England and come and set it up over here. So I landed in Australia in January 92, and by May of 1992, we had these primetime TV adverts sponsored by Channel 7 called Save the Planet that we co-produced and co-wrote, and we ended up doing over 200 of those ads, and they all went in primetime on and off over a period of about 5 years. So we managed to get a really big success right from almost day one in Australia. And, you know, after that, of course, I set up things like National Tree Day. We set up the Planet Ark website in 1996 and, you know, got a content deal with Reuters that still exists to this day for the World Environment News Service. And that's still the best quality environmental news service in the world. And, you know, so we have millions of people using that every year. And then we did things like recyclingnearyou.com.au, which I set up. And again, that has over a million Australians a year using that service, typing in their postcode to find out how they can recycle in their local community. So a lot of things we do at Planet Ark, it's about bringing about positive change in your day-to-day life, whether you're at home, at work, or at play. And so I ran that for 16 years, and that was a fantastic time in my life. But Pat and I basically felt that we achieved as much as we wanted to achieve, way beyond what we ever thought we would with Planet Ark. And about 2.5 years ago, we had a discussion about, you know, why don't we start doing some more social things again? We decided we were going to do a 20th anniversary fundraiser from Smoke on the Water and Rock and Roll. And we thought, well, what else could we do? So it's been a lot of fun in that whole transition and setting up the new Do Something organization,
which we'll talk about a bit more in a second. But, you know, so it's been almost 20 years you've been involved in, you know, Planet Ark, let's say 18 years. You know, I have to say that I think I'm probably still very skeptical about whether or not big business in this country takes the environment very seriously. What kind of changes have you seen over that time?
Look, I think there's been a lot of changes in how businesses are now trying to incorporate sustainability into their day-to-day operations. And I'm actually working with Census at the moment. I'm close to finishing a book on sustainability for SMEs, because a lot of the addressing of environmental issues has happened in big companies. And it's been in one of two ways. Either it's been a constructive, positive way where they're trying to incorporate energy saving, water saving, and other activities into their day-to-day operations. And there is actually some very good stuff happening in that area. But what's had more publicity are the what we call the dinosaurs, who have been really fighting a rearguard action against the significant change that's taking place with the emissions trading scheme that's coming into being. And at the end of the day, there is a fundamental change about to take place for many businesses in how they operate, in that they're going to be forced for the first time to pay to pollute. Because what's happened in the past, if you've wanted to go and put a ton of rubbish down at the local landfill site, you have to pay as a company to do that. But if you want to burn that same rubbish and put it up in the atmosphere, you can do that free of charge. And so that obviously cannot continue because it's contributing to man-made climate change. So what's happening now with this emissions trading scheme is, for the first time, these top 1,000 polluting companies in Australia, who between them put up 490 million tons of carbon pollution into the atmosphere every single year. That's just in Australia. And they're now going to be forced to pay for that. And the aim is, over time, the government will sell them permits to pollute, but over time will reduce the amount of permits they sell, and it's going to force them to reduce the amount they pollute. And now some companies, as we've all seen, have put out a lot of scare campaigns against that. But if you look at the tens of countries that have done this shift towards an emissions trading scheme, the sky hasn't fallen in like many of these people have predicted. And I have to say, there have been some elements in the media who've been extremely irresponsible in promoting stuff that often is baseless, in fact.
But there's been a lot of criticism about the trading scheme. People like Bob Brown have been pretty scathing about how weak it is. Do you think the levels of punishment that are being introduced are sufficient to really change behaviour fast enough?
There's no doubt that the figures definitely could be higher. I think all environmentalists have been disappointed at how ineffective Peter Garrett has been in some areas. Penny Wong...
That must be so. Peter Garrett. I mean, I imagine you've had a lot to do with Peter over the last 20 or so years. I mean, you must be disappointed in his performance.
Look, I am disappointed in Peter's performance. So you just have to look at plastic bags as an example, where plastic bags were coming down in usage in Australia, and Peter made a commitment before the election and after the election to say that they were going to ban plastic bags. He's totally failed to follow through on that, and what's worse, the use of plastic bags under Peter Garrett's watch have gone up by hundreds of millions a year. So he's failed miserably in that space.
What do you think? What do you think happened to Peter?
It's a great question. I admire Peter. Peter has been undoubtedly one of the best advocates for environment when he wasn't in government. And, he's gone in and he's had an environmental lobotomy. There are some things he's been doing, like energy efficiency, where he's actually managed to achieve some very big results. But they're not getting publicity. But the things that are getting more attention are where he is being seen by the public almost to have been totally switched on his core beliefs. He's done a reverse, he's advocated for many years. The problem Peter Garrett has is this: his opinions are extremely well known by the average person on the street, in a way that, for nearly all politicians, you don't really know what their real opinion is, because they're part of the party machine and they, their opinions sometimes swing to whatever the party says that they should be. But because you don't know their previous position, you don't realize just how much sometimes politicians compromise their personal beliefs. The problem Peter Garrett has is that we're all aware of his position on things like uranium, we're aware of his position on old-growth forests, and yet some of the decisions he's made in those areas are almost totally against the public position that he's advocated for many years. And I think that's damaging to him in terms of his credibility, and he's seen that to be signing off on things that we all know he doesn't believe in, but he takes this position that he's a team player. And the problem Peter faces, and it's a difficult position, he's trying to use his knowledge and influence in the political system. The danger is he could get damaged in the same way that Cheryl Kerner got damaged, where you had someone who was had a lot of credibility, a lot of talent, incredible knowledge, who was genuinely liked by the general public, and was spat out the other end, a total wasted person, you know. And you look at someone like Peter Garrett, you look at people like Cheryl Kernow and others, and they go through the political system sometimes and get spat out the other end worse for wear. And I desperately hope that doesn't happen to Peter, because he's actually a really genuinely good man. But at the moment, not impressed.
I mean, Cheryl didn't just ruin her own career. She basically wrote off the Democrats at the same time.
Yeah, that was very disappointing. I mean, that was, you know, I think it's very important that we have strong opposition parties who can give the contrary opinion. And look, I've always avoided getting into politics. Planet Ark was set up as an unpolitical organization that didn't affiliate itself. Do Something has done the same thing. But there's no doubt that on some issues environmentally, political discourse in Australia has been poor quality, especially during the Howard years, where we were incredibly recalcitrant and sat alongside George Bush on climate-related issues. And that was a wasted opportunity. You know, we could have really come to the fore on environmental issues. We've got such potential in this country to create jobs. If you look at renewable energy, there are currently 200 renewable energy schemes currently underway or about to get underway that will create about 26,000 jobs, that will generate about $10 billion of investment into the economy, much of it in regional areas, where farmers who might have farmed wheat in the past are now going to be wind farmers instead. So there is huge potential to create new jobs and new opportunities. And part of our problem is the government are doing an absolutely woeful job in explaining the benefits of emissions trading and how some of that money that's going to be generated from emissions trading is going to be diverted into carbon solutions and making it easier for that transition to us having creating a more low carbon economy. And they've done a woeful job on it. Part of the problem, of course, is that the government are fighting this rearguard action against Malcolm Turnbull, who you just don't seem to know which way he's going. His party is so split on the whole issue that the coalition just don't have a cohesive, constructive policy on climate-related issues. And that's part of the problem with the political debate. It actually has got in the way of us explaining to the public how good the emissions trading scheme is going to be for them. I mean, for example, my hot water system broke down 6 weeks ago and I had to get a heat pump hot water system, which I got from Easy Being Green. Instead of costing me $5,000, which was nearer the normal cost, it's only going to cost me about $500 once I get all my rebates and everything back in. Now, that's going to reduce my hot water bills by about 70% every year, year in and year out. So it doesn't matter if the electricity costs go up. I'm still going to be saving money. And that's the kind of message the government has failed to get out there. And there's one of two reasons for that. One is they're too embroiled in this head-to-head combat with the coalition on trying to get a scheme across the line for, you know, the carbon pollution reduction scheme. Secondly, they're just doing an appalling job on explaining it to people, and they just don't realise they're losing the general population who just don't get what the whole thing's all about. And that's a worry when communication isn't put in place properly for these kind of major changes. You can actually lose the public if you're not careful.
But the Rudd government was voted in the closest we've had to a landslide victory in this country at a federal level for many years, in a large part on his promise to take climate change seriously. The coalition were in disarray, are still in disarray, quite frankly. Mm. And, we're, 18 months in, very little has happened, and the stuff that has happened is looking negative. I just think it's been a complete disgrace.
Look, there's a heck of a lot more they could have been doing. And if you think about the mandate they were given, unquestionably this government had a mandate to do a lot more than they have been doing on environmental matters. And I don't think people in Australia realise how far behind we've fallen in regards to other countries. I mean, when I moved to Australia in 1992, one of the reasons I moved here was I felt that Australia was far more forward-looking on things like environmental and social matters. And what was interesting in the Howard years, when he just took this totally recalcitrant position on climate-related issues, and I say that in an unpolitical way because I really do not get involved in, you know, advocating one party over another, but unquestionably, Howard really held us back on really tackling with climate change once and for all. It was almost, he just repeated whatever George Bush set was to go, then we just mirrored it. And that was a really huge wasted opportunity. And Rod was able to come in off the back of that. And undoubtedly, the general public were dissatisfied with Howard's approach to climate issues. It's one of the reasons why not only did he lose the election, he lost his own seat. People saw that he was tremendously out of touch. And what we're seeing with Rod, I believe, is lots of talk, lots of empathy, but not enough measurable action. And hopefully, once this scheme starts to get up and running, undoubtedly it's not as good as it could be from an environmental standpoint, but it is. There is another way of looking at it. One is that at least it's going to get businesses, even the ones who have desperately tried to stop the scheme getting up and running, those businesses are going to have to start paying for their pollution. The public is going to be shielded from the price rises initially in a way that I think is actually quite effective. But there's no doubt that businesses could have been given a little bit more pain in the short term to encourage them to reduce those emissions. But at least there is going to be some kind of scheme set up. The problem is we need to do that sooner rather than later. All this politicking is as we do that, we're creating more and more carbon emissions. And as I said, those top 1,000 companies involved in the emissions trading scheme, they're generating 490 million tons of CO2 every single year. And if you listen to some people in the media, you'd almost believe that we were putting up very small amounts of pollution in Australia into the atmosphere. We're not. We're creating 490 million tons just from those 1,000 companies alone. That's a huge damaging impact on the environment that is going to affect the ability of my kids and other kids and their kids to come. It's going to affect the quality of their life in a significant way. And what we've got to do with getting this emissions trading scheme up and running and why we've got to advocate for stronger action internationally is that the quality of life that we've known it is, it's not going to be there for our kids and their kids to come, because the impact of that change in our climate is going to fundamentally change the way we live our lives. It's going to have very significantly adverse impacts on economies, on environments, not just in Australia, but around the world. The key issue we're all dealing with now is how are we going to adapt to this climate change? And the thing we've got to do is try and minimize the climate change to a point where we can live a decent quality life. But this problem we have at the moment with recalcitrant businesses, the problem we have with very recalcitrant and quite ignorant politicians, the impact of really some very stupid people in the media who are advocating against emissions trading, those people are damaging the future of our kids, and they have no right to do that. And it's the responsibility of people like me and others who are leaders within the environmental movement to try and get as many people as possible on side and to hold politicians accountable for the claims and promises that they've made. At the moment, it's very easy to make promises, but there's not enough follow-through from the political end.
And we have to point out that, the annual profits of those top 1,000 companies that are pushing out all that pollution is in the, tens, hundreds of billions of dollars a year, executives getting paid in the tens of millions of dollars a year. It's just a complete disgrace when they're destroying the future of the country.
Yeah, that's why I think it's so important that internationally we wear the blue haze, that we can no longer expect that people have the right to use our atmosphere as an open sewer where they can just pump out vast amounts, billions of tons of pollutants every single year, because that is shifting global weather, the global climate. And that, when people say, I don't accept that mankind is causing climate change, get your hand off it. The fact is, it is causing that. All the science absolutely proves it way beyond that. So when these idiots go out there and say, oh, I don't accept it, it's like, yes, how much science experience do you have to make that claim? They're just repeating this rubbish that's going out by a few commentators in the media, and those people are just highly irresponsible. It's just totally ridiculous. And I don't even engage in that debate anymore. The fact is, we are causing climate change. Get used to it. There's no debate. And to actually indulge anyone in a debate is actually damaging, because it implies that maybe there is an alternate argument. There isn't. We are causing climate change, and we have a moral duty right here and now to do something about it. And that's one of the things that, for me personally, makes it worthwhile waking up every morning. I did my first interview on climate change back in 1985 when I began my career as an environmentalist on a full-time basis. And, you know, if you look back at footage, there is footage available from the early 1950s from America where they talk about the impacts of climate change from too much pollution. And so this is something we've known about for, you know, and scientists have known about for 60 years. This is not some recent trend that someone's come up with a theory. This is based on very, very long-standing science and research. And
it's John, let me ask you, why do we still have doubt in the minds of the public after all of that time with all of the data that scientists have? Who is it that is continuing to push these doubtful opinions so successfully? I mean, and I think, by the way, your next ad campaign should be Andrew Bolt, get your hand off it, because I like that. but seriously, I mean, is it? Do we point the finger at the mainstream media for continuing to propagate these doubts?
Well, the part of the problem is this, is you look at smoking. What happened? You had smoking companies, you know, cigarette tobacco companies, you know, signing up doctors to say, you know, my favorite cigarette is X, you know, and you know, you'll cough less with this, you know, no coughing, you know, and almost implying that there were certain brands of cigarettes that wouldn't harm you in any way, shape, or form. And when people got traction against the tobacco, you know, lobby, you know, they would put out, put every resource they could into sowing doubt about the impacts of cigarettes on health. Even though they've known for decades that cigarettes kill you, they know that the products they sell kill people. And yet, despite that, they've sown doubt left, right, and center wherever possible, because when you have doubt, you slow down action on that issue. So just as the tobacco industry did that with cigarettes, you've had the same thing with some major polluters around the world, have put funds into sowing doubt out there. They've, you know, there are always scientists in any field that you can give money to who can come up with research that show an alternative opinion. But the simple fact is this, the absolute majority of the world's scientists have unequivocal proof that mankind is causing climate change. And there is undoubted proof that the world is warming. Of that, there's no doubt. So when you are faced with that, well, the way you can then tackle that, of course, is then to say, well, but the world's warming up, but it's not us. How do you not know it's not volcanoes? And he's a scientist, a volcano scientist. Let him have something to say. So it's always very easy to sow doubt, and the media always wants to present both sides of a story. And when you get to a point where unequivocally, you know, the media accepted that, you know, mankind is causing global warming, well, then you get into the point where how good is it to present the contrary argument that's so far off left field?
But John, when you know, John Howard wanted to support the invasions of Iraq and Afghanistan, the media wasn't providing the other side of the story. In fact, they you know, destroyed the character of anybody who came out and tried to explain that Saddam didn't have WMD. So I don't buy the media pushing this line of, well, we're just trying to provide both sides of the story. That's what we do. That's a crock of shit. They do that when it's to their in their best interests, and when it's not in their best interests, they don't.
Look, it's really interesting, because if you think of you know, you've got Andrew Bolt coming out with absolute crap on climate change related issues. The man's in, you know, I read his stuff and I just think, you know, are you smoking something? That's just like, this makes no sense whatsoever. But you then look at News Limited as a company, and their one degree of climate change campaign that they're running throughout all their companies here and overseas is probably the single best climate change campaign that any corporates run within a company. So it's really interesting that there is, you know, I find that really interesting.
But they're a company that produces a large part of their revenue by producing paper. Same with Census you were talking about before. I mean, surely we should be throwing the book at any company whose business is producing paper on that kind of quantity.
Well, what's interesting with the whole paper side of things is that we are now moving away from the old way of doing things. You know, if you look, newspapers is a really good example where, you know, for me personally, I prefer to read newspapers online, not necessarily in the standard HTML way. Like, the way I think it's going to go, which I'm really interested in, is if you look at the New York Times model, they've got an Adobe Air app that backs up, you know, their Adobe Air version of the New York Times. I find that a lot easier to read than the website. I find it a lot easier to read than the newspaper. And I like the fact that you can get stuff instantly. And the one thing that is exciting now is that the barriers to change we had, for example, on companies using paper are going out the window. And newspapers are a very good example. As an industry, they're going to have to reinvent themselves in a way that their business model is going to be substantially different to what we've seen now. And as we know, and especially in America, many newspapers are actually going out of business because they can't cope with the transition. And so it's going to be very interesting to see 10, 15 years from now where that newspaper industry is going to be, especially once we have the electronic paper, you know, where the one thing that I think is going to be a game changer is when someone like Apple finally comes out with a tablet that makes it easier to interact with your hands with electronic content. That is where, once someone really, really nails that, and I think, you know, if this, you know, rumored Apple tablet comes out, those kind of products are going to spell the, I think it's going to be the death knell for, you know, traditional newspapers, because over time people will realize those kind of interactions on a screen can be a lot more satisfying and a lot more interactive than traditional newspapers.
I think we just legislate it today. No more newspapers, no more books, no more yellow pages or white pages. We have the digital technology for everyone to access all of that information digitally. There's no justification for paper anymore. You know, you've got a year to stop using paper, which leads me to the Paperless Alliance. So let's talk about Do Something and what you and Mr. Cash are going to be doing to drive a lot of these changes at a consumer level. Tell us about Paperless Alliance, first of all.
Well, the Paperless Alliance is something where I've been quite passionate about and advocated that people should use less paper for many years. And what's been interesting in the last 2 years, I've been on this journey of, you know, I've used a tablet PC ever since the early days, the original, you know, Panasonic Toughbooks. So I've always been into this idea of using an electronic pen on a screen wherever you can. And my disappointment with that was the fact that the operating system just didn't quite nail it on the Windows tablet PC. It just crashed too often. So I ended up going back to a Mac. But I believe that once you really nail a tablet PC of some kind that is quick and easy and as easy to use as, say, an iPhone is in terms of your using your hands on screen, you know, I've always believed that that's how computers are going to end up. We're going to end up using tablet PCs a lot more. And as part of that, my using tablet PCs, I ended up looking at, well, what other ways can people reduce their usage of paper? And so I started out looking at what were companies doing, because we've spoken about the paperless office for 20 years, and guess what? Our usage of paper has gone up dramatically in the last 20 years. We have forests full of filing cabinets in offices all around Australia. Some companies literally have buildings that are just full of filing cabinets with years' worth of their information stored on paper. And so what I wanted to do was, you know, when I was talking about going paperless, using less paper, a lot of companies would say, look, we're really interested in this, but where are the case studies? Where are the role models? Who else has done this? Who else has failed? Who else has succeeded? And if they failed, why did they succeed? And so I did a lot of corporate presentations and speeches and found that a lot of companies were very keen on the idea, but they didn't know where to start. So that's why we, you know, we put together the Paperless Alliance, was to get some of the really key companies in the electronic software space and in the alternatives to paper, the electronic document management space. We've got those together in an alliance to fund the campaign. So we have Adobe, Toshiba, Redmap, Indigo, and others. And what we're doing with our website is we've gone out there to find the very best case studies. You know, how can you save hundreds of millions of dollars as companies is from using electronic invoicing and bills instead of posting them? You know, what about electronic forms? How do you store your documents electronically? How do you set up an electronic document management system? So we've been doing all this work, getting some of the best thinkers out there in this space to give us opinion pieces. We've put up, you know, tips, facts, case studies, that show people how you can save a vast amount of money by reducing your usage of paper.
And as part of that, are you, convincing some of the companies that you work with, like Census or a Pratt Industries, to stop selling paper?
Well, Pratt Industries is very interesting. I mean, you've got Visy, for example, have now gone to using an electronic billing system that has dramatically reduced their usage of paper, because Visy, like many other companies out there, are realizing that when you get rid of paper, you don't just save the money on the ream of paper itself. That's only a very small part of the cost of paper. The key problem with paper is this: it imposes inefficiencies on businesses. It's a 2,000-year-old technology. And if you compare the technology of paper with the technology that we have in our computers and the technology available with electronic document management systems, you can't compare the two. So then let's look at some of the savings. Australian businesses, for example, are sending 4.2 billion items every year through the post, and transactional items like bills and invoices and others. Now, why on earth would companies be sending out bills in that way when you've got to pay a postage stamp, you've got to have someone put it in an envelope, you've got all that processing and back end, and not only does it cost money, it also has a major cost on the environment. And so we've now got to the point where everyone's using email left, right, and center. And one of the things I did was I actually set up myself just an account on Hotmail just for my electronic bills. So that way I would never lose my bills when it comes to tax time, when it comes to doing my expenses. All of my bills electronically go to one email address and nothing else goes there. So I've got online, backed up, never going to lose it, all my bills. And so one of the aspects of our campaign is to encourage people like you and I and people listening now to make that switch and go electronic. But we're also really going to be doing a very big campaign to get companies to make that switch, because what we're now seeing is, like one of the phone companies, for example, have managed to get the number of customers who are now having their bills sent electronically instead of on paper, it's now got up to 70% of their customer base. Now, that is the kind of change that we're going to try and bring about with this, because, sure, Australia Post aren't going to like this campaign, but the simple fact is, over time, Australia Post is in an old-fashioned industry where they're going to have to change their business model over time. But for companies out there, why should they be putting so much money into Australia Post bottom line instead of their own bottom line? And that's what happens when they're using, sending stuff by post. It actually goes, they're putting money into another company instead of into their own, and that's what happens. If you use electronic mail to send your bills and invoices, you save a lot of money. Now, a lot of people who have run financial departments where they don't accept paper, where they are using, they're doing everything electronically, though the banking is done electronically, the bills and invoicing is done electronically, you can use a lot less filing cabinets to find a bill in your inbox. Going to take you seconds, whereas if you have the bill in a LibreArch file, it can take you 5 or 6 minutes. And so this campaign is not just about the environment. It's about promoting efficiency. It's about promoting productivity.
John, I worked at Microsoft for many years, and people have been pushing this story for well over a decade now. Still companies seem to be reluctant to move down this path. The business case scenarios have been there justifying it for well over a decade. Why do you think they haven't already adopted it?
Look, there's undoubtedly a shift now. I think one of the reasons why is the software wasn't to the level it's at now. I was looking at some new scanning equipment yesterday that is gobsmacking in how easy it is to scan everything. Where, this guy was amazing. He literally got those little forms you get when you get a courier package, very, very thin, 30 GSM type paper, and he got 10 of those, all at different angles, then threw a few business cards in, then threw in all these different types of paper documents. He had about 40 pieces of paper. None of it lined up or aligned, just chucked it on the scanner and just pressed the button. And this thing just scanned them all and lined them up, and it was amazing. So that kind of technology didn't exist even like 12 to 18 months ago. And so we're now finding that the software, the storage is a lot cheaper, the bandwidth is a lot bigger for doing online backup. There's become this sweet spot has now undoubtedly come about where companies are realizing that hey, you know what, this really has, there's been a major shift here. And the great thing is we're finding the most amazing case studies showing companies saving a lot of money. Now, the Australian National Audit Office have gone to all government departments, holding them to account now on the amount of paper they're using, because they found, for example, that when they store all the Australian National Audit Office documents, they used to store it on paper. They've now gone totally digital instead, and they're finding that they're saving $1.3 million every year just by storing documents electronically instead of on paper. The other advantage they have is from a legal compliance point of view. When you had all these dodgy American companies going bust over, you know, that crazy period where you suddenly realized so many of these companies were behaving in a really dodgy way, you then had all these new compliance legislation came in, so that you had to keep emails, you had to keep certain documents and financials. And what's been really interesting with that is that doing that electronically means that you can access documents very, very quickly and easily electronically, in a way that you simply can't do if you have those documents stored on paper. So it makes companies more legally compliant, and that's become a real driver in this changing of attitude towards this. You unquestionably save money. It improves your efficiency and your ability to find documents and the information that's in those documents. And so for a business who wants to be efficient and productive, it's the only way to go.
Makes it a lot harder for governments to shred files, when the Australian Federal Police are knocking on their doors and that sort of thing, though.
That's absolutely the case, because, I mean, there are electronic document management systems around that will literally record every single email that goes in and out of your company, of every single person. So, because half the battle is, if you have a key member of staff who ends up moving on, you often don't have access to their emails. They could have some really legally important documents on there that have exposed the company. And so companies are looking to minimize their exposure. They're looking to maximize compliance, especially international companies. They've now got very, very tough policies in place on this. And some of these electronic document management systems will record everything that goes in and out of a company, and it makes that compliance a lot easier. And at the end of the day, that means that the board of directors for those companies are also, they're covered too, because if you're not compliant, then the responsibility for that can fall at the feet of the directors on the board. And we've seen what happened yesterday to James Hardy directors. You can get really big fines, and you can get banned from being a director if you don't do things the right way, you don't live up to your directorial responsibilities. So there's been some real shifts in the way that businesses are going about this. And businesses are also looking at low-hanging fruit, things that they can do that will, where they can show that they are making a measurable difference environmentally. And at the same time, the great thing about paper reduction is that you can save vast amounts of money. I mean, for example, electronic forms. If you're a company that has a lot of customers and you need to get them filling in forms, if they fill in paper forms, you've got to go to all that expense of printing paper forms. Then someone fills it in. Inevitably, people always fill in paper forms incorrectly in some way. And then you've got to have someone then read someone else's writing, type up their interpretation of that writing. They can make mistakes as well when they're typing stuff in. So by the time you translate the paper form information into electronic format, you're always going to have mistakes, and then someone's got to fix the mistakes. So it's a very costly process. If you have people putting in their information electronically, you only get the information you need, and you don't have to have anyone reinterpret that information. It's all done automatically. So if you look at the whole company's usage of paper, if you look at the systems, the forms, the processes that rely on paper, it really does hold companies back and costs a lot of money. So the really exciting thing is now is there are many, many companies around the world who have electronic alternatives, and the really exciting thing is that we're getting a lot of case studies where well-known companies have actually done these changes in their day-to-day business operations, and they're saving a fortune in the process. So it's not like it was 5 years, 10 years ago where the theory was there. The implementation 5 to 10 years ago was far too hard. And so one of the things we've done is we've actually come up with some of our own software on our website where we've got free downloadable software where people, if you're just a single person and you want to monitor your printing, we've actually got free software with an Adobe Air widget that adds up all your printing. It tells you what the impact is in terms of the energy and climate impact of your printing, how many trees you've used. But we've also got that same software where you can put it in, you know, a 10,000 computer company if you wanted to, where you can monitor everybody's printing. You can even find out, you know, who's doing the weekend full color printing for the local soccer team, you know, if you wanted to, because it monitors everybody's printing use. You can put a cost on the printing, and that's very exciting. So at the Paperless Alliance website, you know, we've got the case studies, we've got the tips, we've got the examples, we have all the education resources on there, but more importantly, we've also got all the software on there, and some of which is free, that allows people to measure the amount of printing they're doing so they get to understand the environmental impact that they have.
And this is up on dosomething.net.au?
Yeah, so we've got dosomething.net.au. We've got all of our different campaigns, but if you go to dosomething.net.au, you can actually go to the Paperless Alliance website, and on there we've spent well over a year building up all that content, and that will show people how to reduce their usage of paper and not just save money and save the environment at the same time, but also become a lot more efficient in the process as well. And that's what companies are in business to do. At the end of the day, you've got to maximize your bottom line, you've got to maximize your compliance, and wherever possible you've got to maximize your efficiencies and productivity. Because if you don't, guess what? There are plenty of other people in management who will come along and do that in your place. And so the great thing with this campaign is everything on our site, this campaign first and foremost is about getting companies to improve their efficiency and productivity by reducing their usage of paper and using electronic alternatives. And that just happens to help the environment. So we're going in unashamedly with a business case argument with this whole campaign. And the great thing is the business case argument is so strong that if you don't listen to it, you really do deserve to be sacked. You know, if you're a financial director and you don't implement the ideas on the website, your company has every right to sack you because you're not doing your job properly.
Good stuff. I like them fighting words, John. I like fighting words. Look, thanks very much for chatting with us today, John. And you know, I guess you've been doing some great stuff over the last 20 years. You're an inspiration to a lot of people. It's great to see somebody out there who's trying to create positive social change. So keep up the good work.
Thanks, mate. I appreciate it.
Well, there you have it, folks, the John D. story. I hope you're finding that some inspiration for yourself to get out there and follow John and Pat Cash's example. Well, I guess Pat is a bad example. You don't have to be famous like Pat to get something, John, to get something done. So make sure you do something with your life, folks. It's up to us to get it done. This is Cameron out. Thanks for listening. Thanks to our patrons, our sponsors, our supporters for helping keep us on the air. And got lots of more good shows coming up over the next couple of weeks. So if you haven't already subscribed, please go to the website, g'dayworld.com, and hit the subscription button. You can follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/CameronRiley, and I look forward to hearing from you all about what you thought about the show. Have a good one.